The Guardian.
All aboard Football Weekly. Today, Euro 2012 qualifiers latest. Teams from British Isles rubbish, apart from Northern Ireland. Next up, 1-0 to the Hrabi Solokovi. England prepare for Montenegro. Our man in Podgorica gives us the full Monty on the brave Falcons. And why their biggest star wears his pants on his head. Elsewhere, there's relief as health officials declare pool of toxic red sludge no longer a danger to Europe. But they might get a penalty if they go into administration. Yes, ahead of our trip to Merseyside, our Mersey mission, we get the latest on the Liverpool sale. And we marvel at Danny Murphy on tackling. There's your post and one or two other bits, and that should just about stretch to 40 minutes. Football Weekly. OK then, Football Weekly. Extra early, Barry, because we couldn't wait.
No, because it suits your schedule to record extra early, and to hell with the rest of us.
Right, and we couldn't wait.
I could have waited.
Heart of gold beneath the curmudgeonly exterior. Yeah. Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Good morning to you. Synapses are whizzing and a-purring.
It suits my schedule, actually. I'd much rather do it early, get out of the way.
All right, then. Hoping it suits your schedule, listeners. And you, Raphael Honigstein, just back from a Lederhosen Steinfeld experience in Bavaria.
That is right.
Getting back to your roots.
Right, yes, now. Yes.
Yeah, discovering your
inner Teuton. But it's nice to be back in London.
You'll be telling us more later about the Bavarian Olympics?
I'm not sure.
Well, we'll ask. You might be discreet. I don't know. Now, there I was in the intro suggesting that British Isles teams had been a bit rubbish. We'll speak more on that a little bit later. But first, England, Montenegro. Now, England have had two wins so far, but up next, tiny Montenegro. Despite a population of 0.6 million, they are topping the group with three straight wins. Now, Jonathan Wilson, you've just returned from the latest victory, 1-0 over Switzerland, in one of my favourite towns in the world, Podgorica. Hey!
It's a lovely town, yeah.
Is it? What's it like?
Well, it's very small. It's very compact. There's only 200,000 people live there. Oh. Very, very pretty centre. There's obviously some dodgy bits on the edge, but no, nice, nice town. Good food, good booze.
Lovely.
Good place for a weekend break, actually.
All right, then. Okay.
Well, it takes 6 hours to get there, so it depends where you're starting from, I guess. But
all right. In football terms, what's the mood like after this extraordinary run of results they're having?
Oh, it's euphoric. I mean, they can't believe what's happening, and what? Quite understand. I mean, this is a country less than a third the size of Latvia or Slovenia, who previously the smallest nations to qualify for the European Championship. I mean, to put in the context how small it is, the crowd on Friday sellout in the city stadium, 12,000. Now, that sounds like not a lot, but if you take it as a proportion of the population, that's equivalent to 900,000 in England.
Wow.
But you know, you could take seven Wembleys and fit, you know, each member of the population could have a seat in only seven Wembleys. So
you could fit basically the population of, I'm just going to repeat what you just said. You're repeat not everything, just that last bit. Yeah, seven Wembleys. Okay, we got that.
Well, right. Before we came up to the pod today, we were trying to, you know, how little the population of Montenegro is, and I think you could fit them all in a quite a large Indian restaurant.
It would be a huge Indian restaurant.
Be a very big Indian restaurant, Barry.
I once booked out an entire Indian
restaurant.
That
was the highlight of your attempts to define the size of the dimensions of.
I know Jamal's in Oxford. You can get 67 people in because I booked out at once. So
okay.
You would need
Montenegro anyway.
What was the occasion?
Football club dinner.
Good.
It was good. Yeah.
All right. Montenegro, in the 3.5 years since being admitted by FIFA, Jonathan, have climbed from 208th to 40th in the world rankings.
And beyond, because that was 40th before Friday. So having beaten Switzerland, they'll be even higher than 40th now.
All right.
So they're level with Colombia, which is, and will now have surpassed Colombia. And, you know, Colombia, established football nation, ahead of Scotland, ahead of Romania.
How are they doing this? Because they were rubbish before, weren't they? The World Cup qualifiers.
Well, I think they, if you talk to players, you talk to journalists, you talk to fans, so they also, well, we were a little bit unlucky in World Cup qualifying. That there was, I think the 2-2 draw with Bulgaria, they conceded a soft late penalty. And I think that their problem is that they're a nation who produce a lot of creative players. You know, their greatest player, Dejan Savicevic, is sort of a template for Montenegrin players. And The problem with that is that you then, if you don't have many defenders, you have two ways of dealing with it. You either just say to the creators, okay, go out and play, and then you leave yourself very open at the back, or you're trying to get them to sit behind the ball, in which case their creative abilities aren't being used in the dangerous part of the pitch. So you get 0-0 draws, which happened to them a lot in World Cup qualifying. Since Lacko Crenshaw arrived earlier this
year.
Nico's dad, yeah. Nico had a very good weekend as well, scoring twice against Israel as Croatia won 2-1. Since he's arrived, he seems to have found a balance between the two. They've won all three games so far 1-0. And now, I mean, Dejan Savicevic on Friday night was saying that he thinks if they beat Bulgaria at home, that's probably enough to take second spot in the group. Now, that's an amazing achievement.
Especially because they were fifth, weren't they, in the pots of seeds?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Montenegrins are very aware of. Zoran Filipovic, who was the coach before Crenshaw, I remember before their first game, which was back, I think, in March 2007, and he was saying, realistically, over the next decade, what Montenegro had to do was just push their coefficient up to get possibly into the third group of seedings, and then if they got a good draw, they had a chance of qualifying. But to do it from fifth, to beat the teams who are fourth, third and second, and who knows on Tuesday, it's incredible.
Well, we'll ask what you think about Tuesday in a second, but Raphael?
Yeah, Jonathan, I would like to ask you, I think I'm right in saying, correct me if I'm not, that ethnically Montenegro and Serbia are quite similar and there are sort of overlapping in certain respects. So how does it work? Is it still the case that if you're sort of not good enough for Serbia, then you try to play for Montenegro, or has the dynamic changed now?
I think it is.
Are they
changing.
Republic of Ireland of the Balkans? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that.
All right, okay. That's fair, isn't it, Barry?
No.
I mean, certainly there are a lot of players who could play for either. And some people, I think, feel very strongly Montenegrin. Some people kind of. I mean, Marko Bašić, for instance, the centre back, who I think is actually a very key player for them. He plays for Lokomotiv Moscow, a very composed player. And he was very good on Friday. And he certainly spent a long time toying with, do I feel Serbian, do I feel Montenegrin, and decided he felt Montenegrin. So, yeah, that is an issue. I think, I mean, obviously the better they do and the more Serbia slide into chaos, and, you know, their 3-1 defeat to Estonia has done nobody any favours in Serbia, playing for Montenegro will become that much more attractive.
Jonathan, how much of their success is down to the rubbishness of the teams they've beaten as opposed to their own good qualities?
Well, there is an element of that. I mean, I think they certainly played Wales and Bulgaria at good times when they were, you know, managers were coming to the end of their time in charge. Switzerland beat Spain in the summer. They're not a bad team. They were dreadful on Friday, but, you know, normally they're kind of a cohesive, well-organised team. And Montenegro, yeah, deserved the win.
They're 16-1 to get the win at Wembley on Tuesday. Can they produce an upset?
They can. I don't think they will. But, I mean, it's not totally beyond the bounds of possibility.
How would they do it, Jonathan? Is it that man Mirko Vukinic, the lone striker?
Yeah, I mean, Vukinic was absolutely superb on Friday. What I hadn't quite appreciated about him before is he's not just skillful, but he's actually very, very tough, very strong. Stefan Grichting, the Switzerland centre-back, was just bouncing off him. And the goal came from Grichting being... I mean, the goal was actually... Vucinic got the ball, held off Grichting, then held him, created the space by rolling the ball back with his foot, played a 1-2 and clipped a finish. So it's a great blend of physique and technique. And that's, you know, and Vucinic has also, he's become this sort of great moral leader for them. You know, he does seem to produce when they need it. And you talk to any other player and they say, well, you know, we all know Vucinic is head and shoulders above everybody else. Mm. And I think, strangely, they've almost benefited from Stevan Jovetic, the Fiorentina player, not being fit, not because he's a bad player or not because he's disruptive in any way, but just because the balance of a team now, it's easier to get that without two great forwards on the pitch.
You say his head and shoulders above everyone else, his underpants above everyone else as well. His bizarre goal celebration again.
I was about to say, I saw a picture of him in the paper with his pants in his head, and I was wondering, had he played like that for the whole game, or was it a goal celebration?
Was it?
It was a goal celebration, yeah. But it actually took him ages to get his shorts off because his teammates were mobbing him and he was sort of fighting them off to get his shorts off.
Right. Yeah, I should point out it wasn't underpants, it was his shorts. Yes. Underpants were still...
The underpants remained in place.
That would be ridiculous.
He still got booked, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, then. Good.
The other thing is they go to Wembley with absolutely no pressure. And this is what they were all saying again on, you know, Friday night, Saturday morning when I was talking to them. And they were all saying, well, it's pretty much a freebie, this game. But nobody expects them to get anything. They know that, realistically, if they beat Bulgaria at home, maybe nick a point in Switzerland or a point in Wales, that's probably enough to get second in the group, which is way beyond their expectations. So anything they do get against England is an enormous bonus. If they get beaten 6-0, which they won't, well, so what? It's England. It doesn't matter. So, I mean, I think they're the dangerous side because they come with absolutely no fear.
Interesting. The England squad, meantime, that's going to be facing England, went in action on Friday, but several players dropping out already with injuries. Jagielka, Wayne Rooney unlikely to play, is that correct?
I don't know. I know John Terry is out.
John Terry is out. Darren Bent might get his first ever start, Sunderland fans.
Hurrah. Right, he deserves a start. You know? Yeah. He deserves a chance to be shown what he can do. I also think Kevin Davis probably deserves a cap, but it's difficult to see him being part of England's long-term plan. He's only in because of injuries to others, but he probably does deserve a cap. But I'd rather see Bent in because I like him.
All right.
Well, it's something I don't understand about Bent. I don't understand why Sunderland fans are so desperate for Bent to get in the England team. It seems to me that the best thing for Sunderland fans is for Bent to just keep scoring goals for Sunderland and ignore England. And I didn't want him in the World Cup squad, selfishly, because there's two things could have happened at the World Cup. He either played badly and he came back with his morale really low, and or he played really well and a better team and Sunderland bought him.
Right.
So I
had to keep a low profile.
Yeah, exactly. Score the worst penalties in history 3 weeks running and rack up 25 goals and take Sunderland at the Europe. That's what he needs to do.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, that pretty much wraps up things from the point of view of England-Montenegro. Elsewhere in the group, just before the door shuts on part one, Wales, of course, lost to Bulgaria. Bulgaria hadn't won in their previous six matches.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but no, it has ahead. To be now referred to Lothar Matthäus, Bulgaria.
Yeah, nice to see Lothar there, rocking the scarf look. No, it's good to see him. Good to see him. How many clubs and teams has he managed by now, Lothar Matthäus?
Quite a few. You know what the Bulgarian Prime Minister said when he took over, and this is not a joke. He said, well, the best Matthäus will be able to do that is perhaps get married again.
How many times has he been married then?
Four.
All right. Yeah, but anyway, a 1-0 win, the Bulgarians. Ricardo Ricciardo offers this little analysis of the game. Wales tonight offered a spectacular example of what can go wrong when you select a player out of position. Ashley Williams, our most reliable defender, was made captain by Brian Flynn and moved to central midfield. Welsh defence was weakened by his absence. The Welsh midfield was wrecked by his presence. The Welsh attack, he's called Steve Morrison, was neutered by the waves of catastrophe rippling out from Williams' midfield presence. He then goes on to add that Brian Flynn said the side would have a licence to thrill, but in fact contained five defenders, three left-backs and one striker who was playing non-league football a year ago. That pretty much explains what happened there. Barry, you heard something you wanted to add, I think.
I didn't.
Oh, all right.
Well, Wales are missing Joe Ledley now. He's withdrawn from the squad because his girlfriend's expecting, and they're already without Bellamy, Earnshaw, Ched Evans, Sam Vokes. That guy, Ashley Williams, is also in doubt. So
They're in Switzerland on Tuesday.
They're in Switzerland. I'd probably lose. Wales aren't very good. I mean, they have some good players. That list of players that aren't available that I read out, there's some good players there, but they just don't seem to be able to get it together.
This is rapidly turning into a group, and I'm not referring to Capello here, but rapidly turning into a group where all the managers are either getting fired or exchanged, because Ottmar Hitzfeld, Switzerland, is also now under huge pressure, and there's talk of him losing the job. He's sort of ruining his legacy by being very bad.
That would do it, certainly.
Yeah.
All right, excellent.
There's a lot of us doing that.
Well, Zlatko Kranjčar is in the remarkable position of never having lost a qualifier, either with Croatia or Montenegro, which I think is now 13 games.
Wow.
So that's another reason for England to fear.
And he drinks beer at 11 in the morning.
Does he, Jonathan?
He certainly did on Saturday, yeah.
All right. Well, he was still celebrating from the night before, was he?
Quite possibly, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Well done to him. Very good. That's it for part one. Next up, part two. All right, so Wales, very poor. The other British Isles teams, if I can call them that, pretty abject as well, with the exception of Northern Ireland. Why? You know, when you think of the genetic mix-up that is the British Isles, where you can have players from, I mean, a large proportion of the Premier League and the Championship could represent several countries in this kind of little archipelago. Why are they all so poor? They've not got populations of 0.6 million. Why are they doing better? Any thoughts?
No.
Scotland?
Well, it could
Ireland.
Be.
What about Ireland this
Well,
last Friday?
There's two ways of looking at the Ireland result. Yep. One is that there's no shame in losing 3-2 to Russia.
Right.
Which would not be my view, but Ireland were thoroughly outplayed. I could kind of see that one coming.
Really?
And I
was it their worst performance under Trapattoni?
It's the worst one I can think of. They were really abject. You know, their only plan was to lump the ball up to Kevin Doyle. And he's missing for the next game, so I'm not. Then now they have their only plan will be to lump it up towards Andy Keogh or Shane Long, which
or they could
doesn't
play 4-6-0
like Scotland did.
Yeah.
No, I'd rather see my team lose, you know, 10-0
right,
than do what Scotland did against the Czech Republic the other night. That was embarrassing. But yeah,
it's the quality.
Russia
of players,
are good.
The quality of players is just not there.
Really?
I mean, yeah, I would hazard guess that the average Montenegro player is technically a better player than a Scottish player or a Wales player. So it shouldn't be a massive surprise.
Well, there's a strange thing, isn't there, on that Adriatic coast. If you look at Croatia as well, they massively overproduce sportsmen. I mean, not just football, but I don't know anything about this. I'm just saying what I was told last week. But apparently the best women's handball player ever is Montenegrin. They apparently have got lots of basketball players, lots of volleyball players.
They're great at water polo as well.
Right. And yeah, Croatia,
which again
produces
basketball
players,
really
tennis players.
I wouldn't know.
Yeah, it's true. Well, there you go. Yeah, you mentioned the Scots. And Craig Levein, lots of newspaper headlines about how he lost the plot. His quote after the 1-0 defeat to the previously woeful Czechs was, well, the idea was never to attack them, and for a while it worked, which is good, because you do get points for holding it goalless for a bit of the game, don't you?
It was just extraordinary to not play a strike, and they weren't playing a particularly good team.
No.
And Petr Cech said afterwards like that it was the quietest night he'd ever had in a game of football. He didn't have a single save to make, which is sort of unsurprising because there was no strikers.
See, what Scotland need is a foreign manager like Bertie or somebody like that who really will bring them forward.
So talking of foreign managers in Russia, I think this is a really key result for Russia. Because Advocat was under pressure.
All right.
And I think if you look back at Hiddinkstrain, his third game was away in Macedonia and they'd drawn at home against Israel and Croatia and he was under pressure. He went to Macedonia and played a really attacking formation, played great football, won the game 2-0. And this is Advocat's third competitive game. And I think, yeah, this might be seen as a similar turning point. That I know they let in two goals in the last 20 minutes or so when Ireland started bombarding them and Berezovsky was yet again exposed as being the worst header of the ball for his height in Europe. But yeah, that performance in the first hour, I think that shows Russia moving forward again.
Well, they, Ireland and Slovakia, are all tied on 6 points with Ireland top on goals scored. Russia go to Macedonia on Tuesday while Ireland play in Slovakia. Meantime, Northern Ireland are all the way down in fifth in their group, but with 4 points from six, after that 0-0. Did you see this, Barry, with Italy?
I just saw the highlights.
All right.
And
didn't take long, I imagine. Lots of chances for Italy. Boriello, very woeful.
Yeah, and Northern Ireland had two good chances as well that they could have nicked it, but it's it's a great result for them, and I would imagine the Italians are not too impressed
but they're not
drawing in Windsor Park.
Well, except that they never won there. And I think that was a little bit of the expectation that Northern Ireland were going to be a very tough team. And Serbia lost at home to Estonia. So Italy are still top, a whole point ahead of Estonia, having beaten Estonia away. So there you go. From Northern Ireland's point of view, all very good. They haven't scored, though, in seven of their last eight matches. That might be a concern. Anyway, their next match might change that record as they are going to be visiting Brian Kerr's Faroe Islands. That's lovely, on Tuesday. Very good. Jonathan, Serbia.
Yeah, in a real mess, as they were always likely to be after sacking Radjanic. I mean, it was an insane decision. He'd been their best manager in years.
Why did they sack him?
Politicking between him and Tomislav Karadzic, the head of the FA. And they're using the fact he's got this four-match ban because of his protest after the Australia game when he didn't get the late penalty during the World Cup.
Oh, right.
But you'd say, oh, we've got to have a manager who's on the touchline. Yeah, you'd rather have Antic in the stand than nowhere. And I don't think it's any great surprise that things are falling apart there. It's Serbian football shooting itself in the foot yet again.
All right, well, they are they're fourth in the group. Northern Ireland on the same points to them, behind on goal difference, but with a game in hand. So, you know, Nigel Worthington's boys still in with the shout of second place in that group. Or, you know, who knows, maybe even more. Meantime, some other international results for you. I'll just whiz through these, shall I? Big win for Portugal, Rafael. A 3-1 victory over Denmark. You remember Portugal were in some trouble. Brought in their new manager, Paulo Bento. And Nani produced for them. Yeah, a couple of goals for him. Cristiano Ronaldo set up by Nani for the last one. And that's a 3-1 win against Denmark. They move past Denmark in the standings. They're now second. A whole 5 points behind Norway, though. Ooh, Germany. Big game for them. Against Turkey, big game in particular for that man Özil. And how did he perform?
He was brilliant.
Yeah.
He was booed and jeered with every touch by a majority of the crowd who were Turkish, not German. Always likely to be the scenario in Berlin, which is obviously very, very heavily populated by Turkish expats. But he was absolutely brilliant. He showed no nerves. He scored a second goal. He bossed the show. He was quite wonderful, and you know, Germany missed Schweinsteiger midfield. Toni Kroos came in from Bayern, and had all these players who performing quite badly in Munich, Thomas Müller, Philipp Lahm, Miroslav Klose, and they all performed, and they played as if the World Cup was still, you know, was still going on. They played really, really well, and people sort of scratching their heads, not quite sure how Löw manages to keep it going, and it seemed to be progressing still as a team.
So you argue the World Cup is not over?
That is a correct deduction.
Miroslav Klose, another 2 goals there.
Yeah, and you know, and then people sort of saying, you know, why can he score for Germany, can't do it for Bayern? It's really odd. He just maintains that it's just been unfortunate and a bit unlucky in the Bundesliga. Obviously, he's also in a different position because in Germany he's the number one striker and he knows he can probably afford a bad first half or so and he's still be in the team. Whereas at Bayern, one bad game and he'll be on the bench and somebody else will be not scoring currently. So, no, but it was a tremendous game. And it's interesting because Jonathan was mentioning Gus Hiddink before, who, of course, here is known as a tactical master brain because he beat Steve McClaren's England once a few years ago. It's now his third game against Germany. Actually, I think it was his fourth game, in charge of a national team. He's always lost, always completely outplayed.
His record against England is dreadful. Against English clubs or the England national team, there's only that once he's ever beaten them.
Oh. Yeah, but always beaten.
Holland stay top of their group. Klaas-Jan Huntelaar continuing his cracking form with Schalke. And France beat Romania. They're now safely on top of their group. So they've really turned it around, the French. Hurrah. In other international news, Brazil are playing the Ukraine in Derby. Why, Jonathan Wilson?
Because apparently Derby has the largest population of Ukrainians in Britain.
Amazing. And
500.
500 Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough to top the...
Apparently so, yeah. I googled that this morning and that's what I found out.
Oh, right,
apparently
okay.
There's a Ukrainian dance band called Hovala is going to be playing, or they're trying to play.
Trying to play?
Well, there's negotiations going on with them and Derby to try and do their Ukrainian thing on the pitch before the game.
All right. That'll be quite a coup for Derby to pull off, Pride Park.
I was just going to say that when I was on holidays in Turkey, Ukrainian prostitute who I ended up in conversation with on a beach, not conducting business or anything, she just happened to be on the Lilo.
At which stage of the conversation did she reveal her profession?
She didn't reveal her profession at all. The two men who had paid for her company for the day revealed her profession, and they happened to be on nearby Lilos on the beach.
Were they subletting her or what?
No, I wasn't availing of her.
Right.
The facilities at all. I was just talking to her.
Right.
They are people too.
Some men prefer that, of course.
But anyway, she was gobsmacked at how white I was. And then when she likened me to Santa Claus. And then when she heard that I'd been there for like over a week and hadn't got a tan, she thought I was some sort of freak.
Right.
But and I was explaining that I'd put on a lot of factor 30 and all that.
Right, she certainly has an easy manner. I guess that's
She's
useful.
A very nice girl,
yeah.
You know.
Okay.
But I can't remember.
Did she offer to sit on your lap as in your Father Christmas guise? Or?
No. I think Mrs. Baz may not have been particularly impressed if that had... who was also there.
Right.
Were you actually wearing a big red suit with fur? That might explain why you hadn't tanned.
No, I wasn't. But I can't...
Why were we talking about this? I don't know.
It's something to do with the fact... Sorry, I wanted to make the point that the resort I was in Turkey had a bigger population of Ukrainians than Derby.
500. That's where Brazil should be playing the
So Brazil should be playing that game in Turkey.
I guess. Possibly,
Marmaris.
Marmaris, this happens
quite a lot. It also had an Ibrox bar.
Okay.
That especially South American countries have franchised out the arrangement of their friendlies, which is why England are playing Argentina in Denmark, I think, in March.
Mm. Brazil and Argentina are playing in Qatar quite soon, and who have invited the pod after our recent less than enthusiastic remarks about their World Cup preparations, have invited the pod to come and attend. I'm not sure if our schedule is going to permit it, but Matt Hall is in negotiations even as we speak. Are you going, Raphael? I bet you are.
No, I'm going to England, France.
All right.
At Wembley.
Sure.
If it's late November, I'm up for that.
All right. Jonathan Wilson's in. We'll make a note of that. Sorry, Jonathan, you were making a proper point. They franchised out the fact that they play, and they play all around the world. But it does seem Pride Park, it's not the first place you'd have thought to see Brazil strutting their samba stuff.
And so that makes it all the more special.
It does, doesn't it? Speaking of special, I forgot in that little German section there to ask you about your Bavarian weekend. Were you wearing leather shorts? Stag weekend in Bavaria?
No, I wasn't. The stag was, though.
Oh, he was, okay. Yes. What kind of things did you get up to, Raphael?
We slept in a hut without running water and electricity.
Why?
For the night. Yet that is indeed a very pertinent question. I wasn't in charge of the arrangements. And then we went whitewater rafting, although the whitewater bits were few and far between on a two-hour trip down a very shallow Isar that didn't have enough water to really make it very exciting.
Oh.
It was very nice.
Okay, super. But did you not go to the Oktoberfest?
No, we missed that. That was that finished last Monday.
But you were tweeting that you bumped into all sorts of people.
Yeah, it was very strange because Munich is, you tend to forget that Munich, in Germany, call it the Millionendorf, which is a village of a million people because it is quite small and you tend to see the same people all and over again. So are you reading my tweets?
I certainly am.
Yeah. I went to a club... opening of a new club, and Bastian Schweinsteiger and Andreas Ottl came in, which struck me as interesting because Schweinsteiger was, of course, officially injured.
Yeah.
He couldn't play for Germany. He just wondered, you know, sort of what headlines we'd seen on a Sunday morning if he'd been an England player going to a club opening on a Saturday night. And, of course, in Germany, nobody bets an eyelid. Nobody writes about it. It's like nobody cares.
Unlike the News of the World yesterday, who had... big spread, and Joe Hart, England goalkeeper, disgracefully went out and got drunk a whopping 7 days before a crunch international.
That is shocking.
How dare he?
That is shocking. Yeah.
Wow.
And and Marcus Babbel
for him as well. He seemed like a different
seven
kind of
days.
Yeah. Shocking. Marcus Babbel,
and Uli Hoeneß were in the same restaurant.
Right. No, I had the impression that it was the Oktoberfest, and I thought that's not possible because Louis van Gaal said we're not going to the Oktoberfest this year because Bayern Munich are doing so badly.
Yeah, even more impossible, rendered by the fact that it actually wasn't going on anymore.
Right. That was another surprise for me.
Can I just ask what gives football club managers the right to dictate what their players can and cannot do when they're not at training?
Their contract. And that's one of the reasons that Serie A nearly went on strike recently. Because one of the clauses, their collective bargaining deal, which is basically the format, the template, which all clubs' contracts are based on, the new one that was being the club owners were trying to bring in, included all sorts of rigorous and, the player said, draconian controls over what they were allowed to do when they weren't at training. And also what kind of training the managers were allowed to impose on them. And the players successfully got that taken out.
And it was an Oktoberfest clause inserted because the second weekend in the Oktoberfest is actually known as the Italian weekend because traditionally it's got thousands and thousands of Italians attending.
Oh.
Yeah. So did they get that in?
No. I don't think so, no.
But the thing with Bayern was that not necessarily was it seen as a punishment by Van Gaal deciding for the players, you can't go, but because what they do is the whole club goes every week.
Right.
Once a year.
Yeah.
You know, the board, all the people connected with the team and the players. And they just felt, losing 2-0 away to Dortmund on a Sunday, then being in the papers the next day, celebrating, hurrah, we're having a wonderful time, would not be right after the disastrous start in the Bundesliga.
But
so it's more
of
a club decision.
Their social duties to the city?
It kind of is, but I think their social duties to their fans, who would have been very unhappy, I think,
really?
Seeing the players party when they've had their worst start ever in the history outweighed that benefit to Munich as a city.
Okay. Lastly for now, from an international point of view, Argentina beaten by Japan in that man Alberto Zaccheroni's first game of the, what are they called, the Blue Magic, the Samurai, the something, or the Blue Samurai Magic, the Magic Blue Samurai.
Japan.
Extraordinary stuff. There I was marvelling over this. Japan shot Lionel Messi's Argentina 1-0 on last Friday in their first match under new Italian coach Alberto Zaccheroni. Inter Milan duo Diego Milito and Esteban Cambiaso both limping out of the friendly. They're both in doubt for Inter's game against, I think, Cagliari this weekend and possibly for the Champions League after that. Jonathan, though, you shed some light on how this result came about.
Well, it's just an awful long way from Argentina to Japan.
How long?
Well, when I did it, it took me 36 hours.
Trust you to know. 36 hours?
Yeah, I was in a real mess for about a fortnight afterwards. I don't know how you meant to play an international game 48 hours after landing. So I wouldn't read too much into it, and I hope the Argentinian FA don't, and they don't not give Batista the job as a result.
Oh, right, you don't know
what... Did you say 36 hours?
Yeah, I mean, it may be quicker if you go via the US, where I went via London. But the problem is that across the Pacific, there's nowhere where you can land to refuel. So you either have to go north and west, or you have to go north and east. You can't just kind of go...
So even if you hire a private Boeing, whatever, 737, you can't physically fly from Argentina to... Japan?
You're asking me technicalities I don't know the answer to.
You think maybe the AFA actually had some sort of...
They can't have had a stopover somewhere, surely.
Why not?
Because they're professional footballers. They don't do stopovers.
It is possible. With scheduled flights.
But anyway...
36 hours is how long it takes, and it's horrible.
Do you know what the reaction's been in Argentina to the defeat?
There's been a bit of disappointment, but basically people saying, well, it's stupid friendly to play. What was the point? Yeah. And I think also it's put into context the victory over Spain, the 4-1 win over Spain a month ago, because although it's not 36 hours from Spain to Argentina, it's still, I don't know, 12, I guess, probably. And so you can see Spain probably suffered the same debilitating effect that Argentina suffered going to Japan.
Yeah.
So possibly that wasn't such a good result as it appeared.
All right.
Certainly defeating Japan isn't quite as bad as it appears, I don't think.
Does this mean assorted clubs are going to have Argentinian players coming back to them just totally wiped out for the next week?
Well, I don't know as well. I mean, I suspect the players who are based in Europe just went straight to Japan. They didn't go via Buenos Aires.
But they're still going to be knackered, aren't they?
Well, yeah, it's still, I guess, I don't know, 12-hour flight to Tokyo from London.
Yeah. Messi, Tevez, all these players. Interesting. That's it for part two. In part three, posts and one or two other bits we found lying around at the bottom of the cupboard. Part three, then. Posts. Ooh, True Malteser is a long-time listener of the pod in Malta. I was pleasantly surprised to hear our national team mentioned. The idea of a Malta 11 playing in Italy, probably in Serie C, has been mooted for some time, but is unlikely to happen due to the local clubs who own and pay the national team players who are not going to accept depleting their team of their stars. Maltese fans, this is where it gets interesting, would, however, love to see their team compete against other teams at the same level, not as a pre-qualifying group for minnows, but in a tournament similar to that organised by the IOC for the small nations of Europe, a sort of mini-Olympics. Did you know about this?
No.
Well, apparently the IOC allows smaller nations to have their own little tournament. UEFA could hold this for the 8 bottom-ranked teams or countries with the 8 smallest populations, say every couple of years. We would have something to aspire to, a small nations cup.
That would be a blockbuster.
Well, I think that would be a very
good idea. I bet Montenegro are really irked to have missed it because they'd have won it.
Yeah, but then maybe...
But it's too good, no?
It's the sort of thing you want to miss, though, isn't it?
Is it? I don't know.
Oh, I think that's totally patronising from a...
But how
just you not like the superpower. It's not like the Montenegro FA are going to open a letter
doesn't
saying you've been invited to the Minnows World Cup, and they're going to say, yes, hooray, we've arrived.
But as a new nation, it's a way of...
But we've seen new nations, Johnson, sorry to interrupt and all that, but we've seen new nations like Montenegro and Croatia before them, etc. We've seen them burst onto the world scene and actually manage to go to the proper things, like the World Cup. Mm. I mean, being in there, how would Montenegro then demonstrate that they were now ready for the big boys? I mean, they would be, I use the term, ghettoized. Would they not?
Well, but if they won it comfortably, they could say, look, we're actually better than these people in the same pot as push us up the pot.
I don't know, True Maltese, I'm worried now. Crocodile Wenger has news of the Blackpool effect down under. How many of your listeners can answer which Blackpool player scored the winner in an international game during the current break? Looks round blank faces at the table.
Was it David Carney, the Australian left back?
Jonathan Wilson! Thanks for giving us the rest of a little chance to answer. But yeah, you're absolutely right. He can't get a start for Ollie's boys, says Crocodile Wenger. despite leaving the Dutch champions to join them this season. But he volleyed in the winner against Paraguay in Sydney. This is Gura 1-0 win. There you go. Pato wants to flag up the interesting these comments indeed. Competing in the Premier League is more difficult than winning trophies in plenty of countries abroad. Who is the better manager? One of these Champions League guys with a trophy from Holland, France, Switzerland, places like that, or me in this league, the hardest, most highest profile league in the world? Who said that then?
Allardyce.
Mark Hughes. Yeah, it sounds Allardyce-esque, doesn't it? Mark Hughes, disappointing stuff. And as Pato says, big talk for a man with two wins in the last 17 Premier League games he's managed.
Yeah, but unbeaten this season.
Well, all right. But,
I'm very underwhelmed by the big list of Ds beside Fulham's name. Just unbeaten, but what? One win and six draws, something like that?
Keep them up.
Hmm? Well, there is that. And until recently, that was what, you know, the season was all about. I say until recently, until that run in Europe, etc. Other business, rather more exciting, the comments from Danny Murphy, who named and shamed Stoke, Blackburn and Wolves as being the axis of evil behind the recent rash of leg-breaking tackles. Did you see this?
Yeah, I saw the comments, and I think it just proves Danny Murphy's one of the... he shows how former players should do punditry. Yeah, he's been eloquent and sensible in giving opinions.
He's not a former player, though. That's the thing. He's still got to go and play at these clubs. How's that going to be for him?
That'll be all right. I'm sure he's well able to look after himself. He made some very salient points, particularly the one that we shouldn't forget, that the players who go out to put in these rash challenges are generally pumped up by their managers and following their manager's instructions to the letter. And it was good that he named some of the managers, particularly Allardyce, who is increasingly coming to resemble just a big buffoon. And his comments about that he should be manager of Real Madrid were just laughable.
Well, what I would say about Allardyce is that you may know Paul Tompkins, the Liverpool blogger and journalist, and he's got a new book coming out where he values every transfer in the Premier League as though they're modern-day prices. He and economists have gone through and worked out a way of converting a transfer value from 1992 to modern-day value. And having done that, he then works out which managers get their points most cheaply, and Allardyce is top of that list.
No, I think Allardyce has certain good qualities as a manager, and he's done a good job at some clubs he's at, but he really does have notions above his station and his team.
You know, I guess his way of... I mean, I sort of semi-agree with you. I think there's a big difference between managing a Bolton or a Blackburn to respectability in the Premier League to managing a top club. I think, there's a different skill set involved. But on the other hand, what else can he do? You know, he's been more successful than anybody else in Premier League history in terms of getting points on a budget. So, the next step is to be given the budget. If you're not being given it,
I think that's what he was saying about the Real Madrid thing, was he's had to cut his cloth according to his, whatever the rest of that expression is.
Measure.
That's the one. And so, were he to be given a great big role of Ermin Gildersegner...
Does this budget analysis include the wages? Because if you sign lots of Bosman players but pay them more than anyone else can afford... And bankrupt your club. I'm just asking because wages alone are sort of meaningless. I remember once going to, there was an evening with Roy Hodgson who explained that it's not as if Fulham couldn't afford the 2-3 million that other clubs are playing. They couldn't afford the wages that some of these clubs that we mentioned just now are actually paying. That's why they're losing out on certain, he was there, he said that's why they couldn't go for a certain type of player. So if you just add, there's this game that's evolved over the last few years where you just add up sort of the transfer fees and then work out who the better manager is. So it's all kind of meaningless unless you know how much these players are actually being paid.
That's a fair point. Also, an evening with Roy Hodgson, did he sing a couple of big band numbers? Was there a nice supper?
No, Philippe Auclair organised it actually. Sure. Yeah, it was very nice.
Well, of course, nowadays he doesn't have those problems because he's at big money Liverpool.
Yes.
And latest on that, if the court rules in favour of Hicks and Gillette this week, RBS could call in its debt as early as Friday, at which point they might face legal action if they didn't place the club in administration. Previously, it had been thought that the club wouldn't go into administration even if the debt was called in by RBS, because they'd still be a going concern. But apparently, they have a real prospect now, Liverpool, of having a 9-point penalty if it's not resolved by Friday. Given that any verdict by the High Court can be appealed by Hicks and Gillette, it does look like that might be a scenario.
I don't think it's a credible scenario.
No?
That the RBS won't call in the loan if it goes to appeal, because they're just going to make it more difficult to find the buyer if they do that.
With a 9-point penalty, it's not in their interests.
No.
Right.
So,
but I'm not sure why any new buyer would necessarily be put off by a 9-point penalty. I mean, Liverpool aren't going to do anything this season anyway. Maybe you miss out in the Europa League next season.
Maybe miss out in the
down.
Premier League.
They're not going to go down. Even
with if they had 9-point penalties, they'd be minus three.
Yeah, but they're not going to, even with a 9-point penalty, they're not going to go down.
Oh, stranger things have happened. Hertha Berlin finished fourth last year, or the year before last year, and then went down.
Hmm. Equivalent clubs, really. Okay. We're in Liverpool. Must remember this before I open my mouth.
Yes.
So we're in Liverpool next
Sunday.
All right, that's exciting, isn't it? DM Wong says, I think, frankly, people in Britain should be very pleased that, given the lack of domestic fortunes willing to be harnessed in what has today become an idiotic business, that foreign businessmen are willing to stick in a ton of money to ensure the solvency of a football club, whatever their personal motivations may be. Well, when they actually do stick a ton of money in, then, yeah, they should be.
I think I read in The Guardian that one internet supporter, Liverpool-inclined internet supporter, wrote, this is rubbish, we want Chinese, Arab or Russian as an honour, which maybe was...
I think there's a context involved, actually, because... I'm not sure if it wasn't Greg Ruffley.
It was meant ironically, in an ironic sense. But that really shows just how it's become a lottery, really. You know, if you are lucky and you've got a great owner who's wealthy and doesn't care about his money, then you're doing well. And if you've got somebody who uses the club as a vehicle to make money for themselves, or somebody who's just not patently rich enough to keep up with the other even richer people, then you struggle. I mean, there's something...
Isn't it always going to end badly, though? I mean, I know that Chelsea and potentially Man City are looking at unexpected success, but if you're basically basing all of that on factors exterior to your own ability to generate wealth and interest, you know, in your local population, then isn't it always going to be destined to come to a horrible crushing finish at the
end? I don't know. I mean, Chelsea have been fairly sensible in the last couple of years in terms of cutting their wage bill, and they haven't been spending crazy money, and they're sort of doing stuff to make it more sustainable. Of course, the elephant in the room is UEFA's new regulations that are going to kick in, which also partly explain why Man City have been so crazy in this this summer, because they're sort of saying we have to fast track all the spending because we can't do it in a couple of years when we can't lose all this money anymore. But you know, I mean, from what I can tell, from what I've seen, for Chelsea would be an example where it does seem to work, and they've raised the club from a fairly, you know, humble sort of mid-table in terms of economic power position into a club that can sustain a large part of its budget.
Right, and they've certainly added, one might argue about the effect it's had on competitivity, if that's a word, of the Premier League, but it's certainly, certainly made all sorts of stories happen.
Even sure that the long-term issue is that important. I mean, even Portsmouth fans, a lot of them say, well, we'd rather have the FA Cup win than have nothing, and we'd rather kind of be going through the struggle now. Because I think a lot of fans, I think I probably include myself in this with Sunderland. Not that I've ever experienced winning with Sunderland, I don't know what that's like. But, you know, the ups and downs, even the really bad time, you actually sort of semi-enjoy it, because at least something's happening.
Yeah.
The worst thing is just plodding along in mid-table.
Fulham.
Well, no, because they got to you.
No, but I'm just saying, you were saying about all the D's in their thing, you know, that's...
I mean, a club like Sunderland, the last couple of years aside, they're always either getting in a relegation battle or a promotion battle. And so there's something interesting going on.
But it's funny because...
I think actually a relegation would... You know, Liverpool fans, they might enjoy it a bit, a year in the Championship, you know.
Well, as long as it were only one year. I mean, I remember when Sunderland were in the third division, one of the great things being able to swagger around the third division, beating everybody 4-0 and getting soft penalties at home because referees were intimidated by 17,000 crowds.
It's like when Juve got put down to Serie B and Buffon stayed there because he never won Serie B.
Yeah, I think that's he was putting a predictably good-natured spin on it.
But the thing, Liverpool, a lot of Liverpool fans are getting, like, they're so understandably upset, but the worst thing that's going to happen is they'll have to spend a season or two in the Championship. It's not the apocalypse, it's not the end of the world, you know. Mm. I think they need to get just a bit of perspective.
We can help bring them some perspective
next Sunday. I'll bring a big bag of it.
All right, then. Excellent. That, though, is it for today's Football Weekly, says producer Ben, tapping his watch. Many thanks to him for his sterling work on his return from a luxury break in the Algarve. I don't know if he chatted to any prostitutes or other nice folk there on the beach. He hasn't revealed that. Nice to see him back. Lovely to see you, Barry Glendenning. And nice to see you, Raphael Honigstein. And Jonathan Wilson, we must salute you now because you're heading back to the other side of the Atlantic.
Next Monday, I'm off back to Argentina, yeah.
All right, then. We'll have
back mid-November.
Have a lovely time.
So I'd just like to add that the lady I was told you, Ukrainian lady, I was like, she wasn't like some skank with track marks in her arm. She was very classy. Just the way you said that, looking down your nose, contemptuously.
I wasn't looking down my nose.
We all have to earn a living, Jimbo.
Believe me, if anybody knows about whoring, it's Anyway, we'll be back on Thursday with a bit of Sid Lowe, hopefully, and all sorts of other delights as well. So look forward to you joining us then. And for now, from all of us here, bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.